Okay, so we have a holiday vacation package for you this weekend. Okay, you don't have to get on a boat. You don't have to sit on a cramped flight. Okay, you get to eat good food, not food that is unusual for you. But we're going on a holiday with the Buddha. Okay, so the Buddha's a very good person to take a weekend holiday with. He's very cooperative, and doesn't. Kind of blame you for things you didn't do and stuff like that. Buddha will say don't sleep too late on the holiday, though. Okay. And be sure and get up and do your practice. So Buddha does nudge you. Yeah. But it's nice having a whole weekend that we can really devote to the Buddha's teachings and the subject that you asked me to teach on, the four thoughts, turning the mind to the Dharma, is a very vital part of our spiritual practice, because these are the four thoughts that make us interested in pursuing the Dharma path and get us going in practicing the path. And I think this is quite important, because many of us come in and at the beginning we hear about vipassana and shamatha, the union of vipassana, shamatha, the nature of the mind, and bliss and emptiness and dzogchen, and all the attaining the jhanas, and we all go, oh, I want to do that, I want to do that. I want to have some wow experience, I want to sit there, maybe Kuan Yin will appear to me, and then I can tell all my friends how spiritually superior I am because Kuan Yin appeared to me. Did she appear to you? Oh, too bad. She appeared to me because I'm so great, and then we just bolster our ego like that. Okay, so that kind of thing really has nothing to do with genuine spiritual practice. So these four thoughts turning the Dharma are what is going to make our motivation very clear. And a correct motivation for practicing the path is really essential, because our motivation is the most important aspect of any action we do. Not what other people say about us. That's not the most important thing. It's what is going on inside here that is motivating the action. Okay? So these four thoughts, contemplating our precious human life, reflecting on death and impermanence, karma, understanding karma, and the fourth is understanding the nature of dukkha, the unsatisfactory condition of psychic existence. So these four really are essential. Not all of them are topics that we talk about in social contacts. We generally don't talk about the suffering of samsara with our friends. We don't like to talk about death. We avoid it. But these are topics that are actually crucial for us to be able to look at squarely with a reasonable attitude, and then to use that kind of knowledge so that we direct our energy to the path, to liberation. Okay? So we'll be talking frankly about some topics that you may not talk about frankly with other people. Personally speaking, when I met the Dharma, I was very, very happy when my teachers actually talked about death and talked about the nature of dissatisfaction that we suffer from. Because nobody else around me would talk about those things, and yet I had many questions about them. I remember as a kid, there was one big cemetery close to the highway, not too far from where we live, and one day we were driving past it. I was little, you know, and I said to my mom and dad, you know, what's that? What's a cemetery? What's in a cemetery? People who've died. What's death? People go to sleep for a long time. And there was this distinct message, do not ask any more questions. Yeah? And yet death is so vivid in our lives, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, we all face death. As soon as we're born, death is a definite. And then we all face the loss of people that we care about. And things are changing moment by moment. There's no way to stop them from changing. And yet nobody likes to talk about this. So, you know, when we don't talk about things, then there's no way to prepare for them. Yeah. And so many people wind up, die, you know, they're facing death, and it's like, what do I do now? And they don't know, because they've never thought about it, and so they suffer tremendously. So I think Buddhism is quite good in bringing these topics up, and then having a very useful way of approaching these topics. So the Buddhist approach does not make us depressed. Yeah, it clarifies things, and so that we can take action that will benefit ourselves and others. Okay. Also, I was very impressed when my teachers at the first course, they talked about dukkha, you know, the unsatisfactory conditions of psychic existence. Because so often in modern society, we're told, you've got to be happy. At least in America. Yeah, all the advertisements. Everybody's happy. You get this kind of laundry detergent and you're happy. And you get this kind of soap and you're even happier. And you get a red sports car and you are over the moon with joy. And yet, you know, everybody is dissatisfied. They want more, they want better, they don't feel good about themselves. And yet we're told that, you know, going out and buying something at the mall is the path to joy. Yeah? That's what President George W. Bush told Americans after 9/11. Okay? He told us two things. Be angry and go shopping. Yeah, because shopping is good for the economy. Both of those were bad advice. That's not what the country needed to do after experiencing a terrorist attack. But you see, when people don't understand the nature of psychic existence, then that's what they do, and they think that will bring peace and happiness. And then it doesn't, and they're left feeling like, well, what's my life all about? What really is happiness? And what is the path to happiness? And those are important questions, and society doesn't really know how to answer them for us. Because we're told, get more, get better. More possessions, better possessions. Climb up the corporate ladder. Get a bigger promotion. Get more money. Get a bigger house. Get a boat. Get a plane. Yeah? Get this and that. No? And then people get all of that, And then what? Then what? No? No? They're still susceptible to aging, sickness, and death. And there's no way to avoid those. And the rich people have their whole own set of problems. I was, many years ago, Bill Gates' best friend was dying of cancer. He was also somebody who worked at Microsoft. And he was Buddhist, and his wife was Buddhist. Not Bill Gates, but a friend. And so I was asked to come and help at the time for the family. And so I led the memorial service, which was held at Bill Gates' house, you know, or his estate. He didn't have a house, he had an estate. Big thing right on Lake Washington, you know. And after the ceremony, I went back to, you know, my little apartment, and nothing like what he lived in. But I felt like, wow, I'm so free. I'm much freer than Bill Gates and his family, because I can walk down the street and nobody is going to kidnap me, and nobody is going to ask for my signature. Yeah. It's so nice being anonymous. When you're famous like that, oh my goodness, you don't have any privacy. You know, they have children, their children need bodyguards. Can you imagine what would happen if one of the Gates' children were kidnapped? How much the ransom would be? And I was just thinking, you know, he can't just take a walk in the park. Yeah? After the memorial service, I went and took a walk in the park. I said, how delightful this is. Yeah? It's so nice being nobody. So, you know, to really think what is happiness and what is freedom, and is what our society is telling us true or not true? Yeah. Because a lot of just general ideas that we're raised with are fake news. I'm not talking about Donald Trump's fake news. What he calls fake news is usually true. Yeah. But real fake news is telling us that, you know, more possessions, better possessions, are going to make us ultimately blissful. Yeah. That's phony baloney. Excuse me if I use American slang sometimes. Okay, so this weekend we're really going to be talking about these things and delving into them and, you know, really looking seriously. And in thinking about how to do this for this weekend, I thought, well, I could, you know, I've spoken on these topics before, I can just, you know, speak, you know, spontaneously to you. And then I thought, you know, I've been working on a series of books with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and it's going to be His Holiness's major English language work. It's going to be a series. I'm not sure how many volumes yet, you know, but the first volume came out in August, yeah? It's called Approaching the Buddhist Path. Okay, so this is volume one. The second volume is The Foundation of Buddhist Practice, and it doesn't come out until May, so I can't show it to you, okay? But I thought what I would do is give you a little preview of what His Holiness said in the book, talking about these four topics that turn the mind, okay? So, you know, sneak preview. Nobody else has to volume two. Yeah. And if we make it that far, maybe to a little bit of volume three as well. Okay? So I thought that would be nice to kind of kind of read to you and then comment on what His Holiness has said. Okay? So, before we begin all that, I'd like to just have us sit in silence a little bit and clear our mind. Certainly, most of you are familiar with the meditation, observing the breath. So we'll do it just for a few minutes now. Just letting your breathing pattern be completely normal and natural. Don't force it, but simply be aware of the in-breath and the out-breath. And be aware of how the breath is changing in every moment. Never remains the same. So just experience your breath. Let the mind relax. Be aware of the changing nature of the breath. And before we begin, let's take a moment and cultivate our motivation to reflect on how interdependent you are with other living beings, how having all the necessities for life, food, clothing, shelter, medicine, all come due to the kindness of others, due to the effort of others. So reflect on that and be aware of how you can't. In our interdependent society, as one individual, there's no way we can stay alive by ourselves. We depend on each other. So contemplate that for a moment. And feel that closeness with other living beings. Not only with people you know, but also with people you don't know, who are responsible for doing so many different functions in society that we benefit from. So feel the sense of appreciation and gratitude, not only for teachers and parents, but also for the people who work in various jobs in society, plumbing, electricity, garbage collection, all sorts of different actions and duties that we benefit from, that allow us to stay alive and to flourish. So have that sense of gratitude and appreciation for others, even if you don't know them. Improve the quality of your own mind and heart, to purify negativities, to increase virtue, so that you can repay others' kindness through being able to lead them on the path. So make a strong, compassionate motivation to attain Dharma realizations, not merely for your own benefit, but so you can have all the qualities of a fully awakened Buddha: wisdom, compassion, power, skillful means, that will enable you to most effectively benefit other living beings. So contemplate that, make that as the motivation for being together this weekend. So we just generated quite a noble, far-reaching motivation to be of the greatest benefit to each and every living being. And that's our ultimate goal. Right now, we're not capable of doing that. So we have to start at the beginning of the path and then progress gradually in the path, step by step, continuously purifying negativities, developing good qualities, planting the seeds of the teachings in our mind. And so one of the first topics the Buddha recommended we contemplate in that sequence to reach our final goal of awakening is to think about our present opportunity, and the fact that our present life has so many good conditions in it that enable us to practice the Dharma. So this is the first thought that turns the mind to the Dharma. It's the topic of precious human life. So precious human life doesn't mean any human life. There's over 7 billion human beings on this planet, but not all of them have a precious human life, even though they all have a human life. Because a precious human life is one that has that is free of obstacles to practicing the Dharma and has all the conducive conditions necessary for practice. Okay? So we're going to go through those now, and I'm going to read from you from Solomon's, read to you from Solomon's book. And as a reading, you can check if you have these different qualities, if you have these different freedoms and fortunes. And if you do, to rejoice that you have each one, because it gives you the opportunity to progress along the path in this very lifetime. Okay? So, we're going to start. This is in Volume 2, the Foundation of Buddhist Practice. And it's Chapter 8, The Essence of a Meaningful Life. I'm going to start the second section of this chapter. So whatever activity, mundane or spiritual, we do in life, self-confidence is a crucial internal factor to accomplish it. That's true, isn't it? Yeah, we have to have self-confidence. We must have conviction and trust ourselves, believing that we can successfully complete that work. Developing self-confidence and appreciation of our potential are the chief purposes of contemplating our precious human life. Okay, so that's what we want to come out of doing this meditation with. Self-confidence and appreciation of our potential so that we feel energized in the Dharma. As we do this meditation, the conviction that we can definitely transform our mind and gain spiritual realizations will grow. Okay? Because if we have a very limited view of ourselves, if we think, you know, I'm just little old me and I have all these problems and I can't do things and I'm not very smart and people don't like me and, you know, I just, you know, if we feel that way about ourselves, then we prevent ourselves from practicing. We don't even try, because before, we tell ourselves we can't do it. So this meditation is helping us overcome that kind of obstacle. Okay. As recognizing the potential of our precious human life is essential. Without it, we may spend a lot of time complaining about upsetting events around us, from personal problems to environmental destructions and war. How many of you like to complain? I have my PhD in complaining. Yeah, if you ever need a complaint, ask me. I will come up with one for you like that. You know? The mind, you know, the ignorant samsaric mind finds fault with everything, complains about everything. Yeah. And we spend so much of our life's energy complaining. Yeah. Tea isn't hot enough. What is this? Hot orange juice? My cushion is not really, it's too hard and it's sloppy. The temperature isn't quite right. I want the whole room filled with people. You know, and I want a different president in my country. You know, it's like I can complain from everything from the tiniest little thing to world matters. Yeah, always complaining. And one of the favorite things we like to complain about are our employer and our family members. You think so? Yeah. Always, you know, your boss could use some change, couldn't he or she? Yeah. You have so many good ideas for your boss, how they can change, become a better boss, do things better for the employees, for the company. You try out of compassion to tell your boss to give them some suggestions. And they don't listen. Oh, the nerve. Your family members, you have some advice for them too? Okay. Yeah, for your husband, lots of advice. Huh? Yeah, or for your wife, lots of advice. Yeah. Also for your kids. Your kids, you know, you got 98% instead of 100%. What a failure. You should get 100%. Why? Because you're my child. Yeah? So we complain about everything. You know? We have this amazing possibility to gain deep spiritual realizations with our life. And what do we use our time doing? Complaining. Yeah? It's my favorite pastime. I can complain so easily. Can you complain easily? I'm sure you have many complaints about my talk already. Just keep them to yourself. Okay? So, yeah, because if we don't recognize our precious human life, then we'll just spend so much time. Does complaining make you happy? No, we're miserable when we complain. Makes us very unhappy. So then we complain about being unhappy. And it makes us more unhappy. So this is what Dharma's teaching us to do, is see things from a different perspective. So that we're not always picking faults with everything and complaining about it. Consistently focusing on misfortune prevents us from seeing the good in the world, and this narrow and unrealistic vision hinders our well-being as well as our enthusiasm for Dharma practice. True, isn't it? Okay, you have some homework. Five times each day, yeah, for the next week, whenever you find yourself ready to complain about something, be quiet. Okay? You think you can do it? Yeah, five times every day? You're ready to complain or criticize? Be quiet. Yeah. And try and see the good in this situation. My mind this morning,
Oh, I'll tell you. Yeah, how I do. This is practical Dharma advice, what I do. Okay, so this morning, I was drinking my tea, and I didn't like the kind of honey that was in the tea. It made the tea taste really awful. Yeah. Why am I drinking this tea with this kind of honey? Yeah, I want nice tea in the morning. Okay. And then, you know, my mind was really getting into complaining about it. And then I thought, and this is one of the Buddhist techniques for transforming the mind, I thought, oh, my self-centered thought, it wants really delicious tea. And instead, I made myself a cup of not-so-nice tea. Nobody else made it, I made it, okay? So my self-centered thought is not getting what it wants. Now, my self-centered thought is actually my enemy. It causes me tremendous suffering because whenever I act out of selfishness, I trample on other people's feelings, I commit a lot of negativity, negative karma that makes me experience suffering in the future. My self-centered thought blocks my spiritual practice. It is not my friend. It's actually my enemy. So this tea is making my self-centered thought unhappy. Okay. So this tea is making my enemy unhappy. That's good. That's good. Look, self-centered thought, you aren't getting what you wanted. You know? So after I looked at the situation that way, there was no complaining about the tea. Because my mind was now saying, oh, it's good that I'm not getting what I want. Yeah? Usually when we don't get what we want, we moan, we groan, we complain. We blame. Here's a technique from the Buddha, how to deal with situations when we don't get what we want. Say, great, that's wonderful. My selfish mind is suffering, and my selfish mind is my real enemy. Are you getting what I'm saying, how to do this? If you can remember to do this, it really cuts the unhappiness very quickly. So I even took another sip of that bad tea after that to say, look, self-centeredness. Okay? So this narrow and unrealistic vision hinders our well-being as well as our enthusiasm for Dharma practice. So whenever this complaining mind, you know, dissatisfied mind comes up, we have to notice it and transform our way of looking at the situation. Okay? Whenever the mind comes up that wants to blame somebody else for our problems, we've got to stop and say, my problems are due to the karma I created. They aren't due to the other person. They're due to my own selfish actions, either earlier this life or in a previous life. So there's no reason to complain now. I'm just experiencing the result of actions I did myself. So again, self-centeredness, you're unhappy, but you created this problem. Yeah. Because if I have problems now, they're due to my negative deeds in the past, aren't they? Isn't that what the Buddha teaches us? Yeah. Our third thought turning the mind to the Dharma is reflecting on karma and its effects. So we always like to talk, oh, karma, karma. Yes, I believe in karma. Yeah. whenever something good happens, oh, it's my good karma. But whenever something bad happens, what did I do to deserve this? Yeah, now we want to blame it on somebody else. It's just the result of our own actions. We've got to accept it. If we accept it, then we can use that as a motivation to change our actions in the future so that we don't create more suffering, more causes for suffering ourselves. Okay? So again, here's another method for transforming daily life difficulties into the path to the Dharma by being able to see them in a different light. Okay, so this is real Dharma practice, when you can transform and, you know, change a negative thought into either a neutral thought or even into a positive one. That is real Dharma practice. Everything else we do is just an aid to get us to change our mind. These robes are not Dharma practice. Yeah? Saying Namo Tassa 100 million times is not Dharma practice. Because a tape recorder can do that. But really transforming our own thoughts, that is what Dharma practice is all about. Okay? So we can do it everywhere, anywhere. Okay, not every human life is a precious human life. A variety of conditions must be present in order to have a precious human life that can be used in a meaningful way. When the Buddha was alive in India, people had access to an awakened teacher. But not everyone was interested in hearing his teachings. And among those who were, some had previous commitments or health conditions that impeded them from doing so. Sadly, these people had human lives, but not precious human lives. How many of you have been on pilgrimage to Buddhist holy sites? Well, many of you, yeah? You know, when you're in Bodh Gaya, that's the holiest place on the planet, you know? With the stupa, the descendant of the tree that the Buddha sat under when he attained awakening. You know, it's the holiest place on the planet. And yet, around the stupa, you have people selling tea, people selling little Buddhist trinkets just to make money. Yeah, you have all sorts of people who don't care beans about the Dharma or about the fact that they're sitting there in the holiest place on earth. All they want to do is make a little bit of money selling their tea or selling their Buddhist trinkets. And yet, there they are, so close to the Tree of Enlightenment. And so many masters go and teach in Bodh Gaya. And those people around are so close to those masters, but they never go to the teachings. Never. Yeah? They make tea instead. They drive taxis instead. When you think about it, it's really sad, isn't it? Because on one hand, they have the perfect opportunity. On the other hand, they're wasting it, yeah, to earn a few rupees. Okay? So this is the whole idea for us to look and see, are we using our precious human life properly? Or are we wasting it, you know? Wasting our time doing things that really don't help us on the path in the long term, and that may even create more negative karma. Okay? A precious human life is free from the 8 impediments and endowed with 10 fortunes. Okay, so there's 8 freedoms and 10 fortunes. Of the 8 unfavorable states, 4 are rebirth in non-human states. Although these rebirths are temporary, the person is impeded from practicing for the duration of these impediments. Okay, so here's four impediments, you know, that we could have experienced this life, but we didn't. Facing intense physical torment, hell beings are unable to direct their minds to spiritual practice. How fortunate we are that we weren't born in the hells this life. Hungry ghosts are distracted from spiritual practice by extreme hunger and thirst, as well as by their constant search for food and drink and the frustration of not being able to procure them. So thank goodness we weren't born as a hungry ghost this lifetime anyway. Animals are eaten by other animals higher on the food chain, often mistreated by humans, and are mentally incapable of understanding Dharma teachings. Okay? Now, the first two, hell beings, you know, hungry ghosts, we can't really see with our eyes. Animals we can see. Yeah? Can you practice the Dharma if you're reborn as an animal? Yeah. At our abbey, we have four cats. Yeah. I know you people don't like cats as pets, but in America, we love cats and dogs as pets. Okay? So we have four cats. We love them. They're spoiled. We dote upon them. They come to so many Dharma teachings. Yeah. Really, because I, you know, every Thursday and Friday night, we live stream teachings. All the cats, we make sure that they're there in the room to hear the Dharma. Okay? We keep trying to teach the cats about ethical conduct, especially the first precept, not to kill. But, and we try and prevent them from going outside because there's, you know, gophers and mice and all sorts of living beings outside. And we have living beings come into our abbey too, lots of different kinds of bugs. But we try and tell the cats, you know, don't chase the gophers and the mice because they want to live. They want to be happy just as much as you want to live and be happy. And the cats just look at us. You know, what are you talking about? Yeah? So even the very first precept, they can't understand. So we're really fortunate to have human intelligence so that we can at least hear and understand the precepts. Of course, we understand the precepts up here, but when we go out for a live seafood dinner, then we forget the precepts. Yeah. Oh, that one about not killing, that's for other people to eat. But I want fresh prawns tonight. Okay? Not so good on our part. So we have this human intelligence. It's very precious. Okay, a fourth type of rebirth that we're free from is those born in the discriminationless gods. So this is a type of god in the fourth jhana of the form realm. And they have almost no mental activity during this life. Born there because of having cultivated the meditative absorption without discrimination in the previous life, their only moments of clear discrimination occur at the time of their birth and death. So there you are in blissful samadhi with no mental activity, impossible to practice the Dharma. And when the karma for that blissful samadhi runs out, kerplunk, you're back in the desire realm with all the problems. So this lifetime, we're free of those four situations. We're very fortunate. A precious human life is also free from four disadvantageous human conditions. So first one is living in a barbaric, uncivilized society or in a country where religion is outlawed. Now, the definition of a barbaric, uncivilized society is one where the Dharma is not existent. When I was born in America, that was really the situation. Yeah, very difficult to encounter the Dharma. When I met the Dharma in 1975, yeah, I didn't speak any Asian languages. There was no place to go, really, for me to learn the Dharma in English. So I had to quit my job and go halfway around the world to Nepal and India. Yeah. Because America was basically a barbaric land. It still is. Okay? You can tell what I think of the present administration. I don't keep it in. Okay. But, you know, why we have an abbey there is we're trying to do our part to change the country and spread peace and goodwill and so on. Okay. Or living in a place where religion is outlawed. I had a friend who used to, this was before the fall of the Iron Curtain, so he used to go to Eastern Europe to teach the Dharma. And he told me that in Czechoslovakia, what they did, because it was illegal against the law for people to meet together in a religious situation, and certainly not a Buddhist one, because nobody was Buddhist there. So when he went to teach, it was always in somebody's flat. People came at different times, so it didn't look like there was a public gathering. And in the outer room, they set up around a table, they set up a card game. And then in the back room, they went and had the teaching. And that way, in case the police came, they could easily go out to the front room and pretend that they were all playing cards and prevent arrest. Yeah. Can you imagine living in a place where you don't have the freedom to practice your religion? Yeah. This is what happened in China and Tibet during the Cultural Revolution. People were thrown in prison for even moving their lips reciting prayers. Yeah. We're so fortunate not to live in that kind of climate. Then another situation that we're free of is living where the Buddha's teachings are not available or during a time when the Dharma has not been taught. Okay, so in a way this was like my situation when I first met the Dharma. The teachings really weren't available in America. Yeah. Now there's many more Dharma centers and teachers coming, but at that time, very little. A third impediment is being severely mentally or physically impaired, so that our ability to learn and practice the teachings is extremely restricted. Okay? So having a physical or mental impairment, that makes it difficult for us to practice. Some years ago, I was in Denmark teaching. This was in the 80s. And a friend of mine who invited me there, she worked in an institution for mentally retarded children, mentally handicapped children. And so I wanted to go and visit there. So she took me, and when she first opened the door to the wing where these kids were, my first impression was, wow, so many beautiful colors, because they had toys for the children, you know, red and blue and pink and yellow and balls and
dolls and Legos and all the trains. The room was filled with beautiful colored toys. And at first, I didn't see any children. I saw the colors. And then I heard, I started hearing very strange sounds. And then my eyes focused more. And I realized, oh, there were children among all those toys. But those children were very severely mentally handicapped. They couldn't talk. Yeah. Some of them were physically handicapped. They couldn't move. It was so sad. It just broke my heart being there. Yeah. They had so much wealth around them, so much love around them, and yet they could not meet the Dharma. They could not understand the Dharma. It's a very sad situation. So again, we're free of that situation. We're quite fortunate. The fourth disadvantage is instinctively holding wrong views, making our mind unreceptive to examining new explanations of dukkha, its causes, its cessation, and the path leading to that cessation. Okay, so some people hold such strong, wrong views. You try and talk to them about past or future lives, they say hogwash. Past and future lives don't exist. When you die from this life, everything's finished. That's it. Or you try and talk about karma, how our actions have an ethical dimension. And they say, rubbish! You can do whatever you want. There's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no rebirth. Just do whatever you want, just don't get caught. Yeah? Because whatever you do, it doesn't really matter. So go for it. Be selfish. Get everything you want for yourself. Just don't get caught. Yeah, very bad wrong views. Yeah. So somebody who thinks like that, you try and teach them about karma, and again, they don't listen. And you may have had experience with people who try and convert you to another religion. Yeah, you had experience with those people? I wind up sitting on planes next to them quite often. Sometimes even on an international flight. Oh, so long. But on one flight, yeah, the man sitting next to me, you know, again, he was saying, you've got to believe in God, you've got to believe in Jesus, you know, and I'm telling you this out of compassion, because if you don't accept Jesus as your savior, you're going to hell. Yeah, that's what somebody says to you. Like, hi, nice to meet you, you're going to hell. And I said to him, I said, you know, if you say God is compassionate, then I don't know why, you know, I'm talking his paradigm now. If God is compassionate, why would God send me to hell? Because I'm living an ethical life. I keep the precepts as best as I can. I try and be kind and compassionate. Why in the world would your God, who's supposed to be compassionate, send me to hell? He didn't quite know what to say. And then I said to him, you know, I feel disrespected because I'm following a spiritual path that teaches good ethical discipline. Yeah. It may not be the same path as you're following, but it makes sense to me. It's helping me be a better person. And I think you should respect me for that and not threaten me. I just told him the truth about what I felt. So he was quiet after that.
And when the flight was landing, he did acknowledge. He said, oh, maybe I did, you know, push too much. I'm hoping that made him think. Okay, so those are, when meditating on the 8 unfavorable conditions, do not simply think of other people born in those states, but imagine living in those circumstances yourself. Then recall your current freedom from those limitations and appreciate the excellent conditions you have now. Okay, so when you meditate on this, you imagine being born in those 8 unfree states, those 8 impediments. And you imagine, what would it be like to live like that? And would you have any opportunity to practice the Dharma? And then, in your meditation, you come back to your present life and say, whoa, I'm free of that impediment. Look at the opportunity I have to practice now. I'm so relieved. I'm so fortunate. So this feeling of fortune is not arrogance. Yeah. It's realizing that in this life, we're experiencing the results of our own good karma, and we are very, very fortunate. Then reflect on the 10 fortunes you presently have. 5 of these are personal and 5 come from society. So the 5 personal fortunes are 1, being a human being with human intelligence that enables you to learn, reflect, and meditate on the Buddha Dharma. So we have that ability right now. How incredibly fortunate, aren't we? And I really want to congratulate all of you people for coming here on a Saturday and Sunday when you could be sleeping all day at home because it's your day off. Or you could be out, you know, doing some sports activity, or you could be at the mall shopping, you know, or at the movies. Yeah, but you chose to come to learn the Dharma on your day off and to use your human intelligence in a really way. And I want to thank you for that. You know, you made a very good decision. Okay, the second fortune is living in a central Buddhist region where the 4 types of Buddhist disciples are found. Male and female fully ordained monastics, so bhikshus and bhikshunis, and male and female lay followers with the 5 precepts. In terms of Vinaya, a central country is one where a sangha of 4 or more fully ordained monks or nuns lives and performs the 3 major Vinaya ceremonies, the fortnightly confession, the rains retreat, and the invitation for feedback at the conclusion of the rains retreat. Okay. So here in Malaysia, you have people holding the Vinaya, doing those 3 main practices. And you have some bhikshu and some bhikshuni sanghas as well. Okay. Now, not all of the Buddhist traditions have the bhikshuni sangha, because the lineage for giving the ordination died out many centuries ago. And so there is currently a movement to revive the bhikshuni lineage and give the ordination again. So the ordination lineage still exists in China, Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam. Yeah. In the Theravada countries, it hasn't existed. In Tibet, it also hasn't existed for many centuries. But now there's a movement to start the ordination again. And so in 1998, some nuns from Sri Lanka went to Bodh Gaya. There was a big ordination there given by the master Fokwan Shan.
He gave the Bhikshuni ordination, and then some Theravada monks confirmed that, and then those Sri Lankan nuns went back to Sri Lanka, began to practice as Bhikshunis, and began to give the ordination again, which is really wonderful. In the case of the Tibetan tradition, they still don't have the lineage in their own Vinaya tradition. And so, for example, I went to Taiwan to take the ordination. Yeah. So at our abbey, our practice lineage is Tibetan, but our Vinaya lineage is Dharmaguptaka. That's the one that's practiced in Taiwan. So I think this, having the Bhikshuni Sangha again is really important, because it fulfills part of the definition of having a central country. Because a central country, you need to have male and female sanghas, and male and female lay practitioners of the five precepts. So many of the objections that people put up for reinstituting the Bhikshuni ordination in Theravada countries or in Tibet is that the lineage is broken and there's this problem and that problem. But we have to remember that the Buddha set up the conditions for a proper ordination in order to enable women to ordain, not to prevent them from ordaining. Yeah. And so there are ways, there are certain passages in Vinaya that can be pointed to where you can make the case for a legitimate Bhikshuni ordination. So it's my hope that in the coming years this becomes more widespread, because half of the world's population is women. Yeah? And certainly the Buddha wanted all sentient beings to become awakened, and so wanted all sentient beings to have the opportunity to ordain, you know, if they're human beings and they have the right conditions and so on. So I think reinstituting the Bhikshuni ordination is very important to fulfill the Buddha's wishes for the spread of the Dharma. Okay, then the third condition, having a healthy body and mind. So yes, we fall ill, and we may have various illnesses now, but we can still practice the Dharma. Here, having an unhealthy body and mind refers to really what I was talking about before, where it makes it so you really can't practice. So, you know, if you're in coma, for example, yeah, you can't practice, or very severe injuries. But just falling ill, even having cancer or kidney disease or whatever, we can still practice the Dharma. Okay, and the fourth is not having committed the five actions of immediate retribution. So these are killing one's father, mother, or an arhat, drawing blood from a Buddha, or causing a schism in the Sangha. So we haven't done any of those. Okay. Then the fifth one is having belief in things worthy of respect, such as the Vinaya as the basis of Dharma practice, and the three baskets of teachings on ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. Yeah. So you have faith in those things. Yeah. And you know, Vinaya, Sutra, Abhidharma, those are things worthy of respect. You have that respect. You want to learn those things. That's another good condition. Then there's five fortunate factors that come from society, and they are living at a time and place when a Buddha is present in the world. Okay. So the Buddha isn't really present now. Yeah, but the teachings are, and the lineages, so that's good enough.
So that's the sixth condition. The seventh is the Buddha taught and is still teaching the Dharma. So although these two conditions are not strictly fulfilled now, there are presently qualified spiritual mentors who give the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, and this suffices for fulfilling these two conditions. Okay? Then condition number eight, those teachings still exist and are flourishing. The transmitted Dharma of the three baskets exists and is propagated, so the scriptural Dharma, we have that lineage, and the realized Dharma of true cessation and true paths exists in the mind streams of living practitioners. So there are people nowadays who have attained the goal of the path. Yeah, so there's a living tradition of spiritual mentors who can impart the teachings orally and through their example. So again, we're so fortunate. I noticed when I came in, you have a statue of Keshri Dharmananda downstairs. So I was very fortunate when I lived in Singapore and came to KL on several occasions. I had the fortune of meeting Bhante. You know, you look at Bhante's life and how he dedicated his life to spreading the Dharma, in Malaysia. I mean, think of where you people would be if Bhante had stayed in Sri Lanka. Would BGF exist? Would Brickfield's temple exist? Yeah? Bhante made an incredible contribution to the spread of the Dharma here in this country. And he was so open-minded and flexible and non-sectarian. Yeah? So he's an example of the kind of person that is doing this work that we're able to meet and contact and learn from. Okay, then the ninth condition is there are spiritual mentors, monastics, and other like-minded people who follow the Buddha's teachings and inspire us by showing that the Buddha Dharma is a living tradition. So I think that's important, you know? There's still a living tradition. It's not just texts. It's not just words. There's people who are practicing the Dharma and getting the results, and who then, out of their own compassion, teach the rest of us. Again, how fortunate we are. And then 10, there are benefactors who offer the four requisites for life: food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. So that, in one way, applies to monastics. There are people who support the monastics so we can practice. But it also applies to you, in the sense that your boss gives you the money so you have food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. Yeah. The point of this one is that we're not living in abject poverty, because that would really be an impediment for practice. So the fact that we're able to procure what we need to stay alive, and even more, yeah, it's a great fortune that we have. Okay? So His Holiness continues, reflect individually on each of these points and see that you have an advantageous situation and all the necessary conditions for serious practice. Allow this to gladden your mind and give you great enthusiasm and self-confidence. Okay, so that's how you want to come out of this meditation, really with feeling very fortunate and having a lot of enthusiasm. So, let me pause here. Any questions or comments so far? Please feel free to ask whatever you like.
Morning, Venerable. I'd like to ask about the part where you said about the street peddlers in Bodh Gaya. It's so close to the place of spirituality, but yet they are doing what they have to do. I mean,
probably like since you mentioned about poverty, you have to do what you have to do. So if what you're trying to say, I'm a little bit confused. What do you expect them to do in such a situation?
So this is not, it's a very good question. This is not a criticism of those people. Because when we go to Bodh Gaya, we need to drink the tea they make. Don't we? Else we get too thirsty. And we get the goods that they sell. So I'm not criticizing them. But what I'm saying is that this lifetime, they don't have the karma so that they can, so that they're interested in the Dharma and can really make use of their opportunity. So we may not have been born in Bodh Gaya, but we're very fortunate because we have the material wherewithal, and we also have had the ability to encounter teachings, to encounter the teachers, to have a beautiful place like this to meditate. Okay? So we're fortunate in that we weren't born in the situation that they're in, where they have to, you know, make a living like that, and where in their minds they have no interest in the Dharma. Okay? So like I said, it's not criticizing them and saying, oh, they should all stop drinking tea and or making tea and they should all go practice the Dharma. But it's just saying they don't have the fortunate circumstances in their life that allow them to have the faith in the Dharma that would help them, you know, make use of other good conditions they have. Does that make some sense to you?
Yeah. I was just a little bit confused there.
Yeah.
I know you were not criticizing them, but then on the other hand, what else do they do?
Right.
Because I think they were probably earning an honest living.
Yeah. They're earning, well, selling Buddhist relics, you know, and Buddhist things is karmically not so good. Yeah, to sell those things to earn a living is not considered right livelihood, okay? Because you're selling, you know, Buddhist trinkets and so on with the same kind of mind as somebody would sell used cars. You know, you bargain to get the most money for yourself. You use the money, you know, to support your family. So while supporting your family is good, selling the Dharma in order to do it is not considered something that's good to do.
But if they don't sell it, we wouldn't have the Buddha's name.
Very true. But you know what they used to do in ancient society is they did, people would make artifacts, and then people would donate money to them and then take the artifacts. So if they live off of donations, that's fine. But it's the idea when we sell things, we always up the price so that we can get more for ourselves, and we bargain, and that's the part that is not so nice. Okay. I want to make sure, do people understand this? Are you clear about this?
Okay. So what about temples selling those trinkets?
Temples selling trinkets? Yeah, I think it's much better. I noticed here what you have for many different things. You have a donation box. There's lights downstairs with a donation box. You want to offer to the Buddha? You make a donation, you take a candle, and you offer. Yeah, so it's best to do things when we can by donation, not by charging. Yeah. This it does present some problems. So for example, there are commercial Buddhist publishing companies. Yeah, and some of my books have been published for free distribution. You have some out there. But books like this, you know, with His Holiness, it was published by a commercial publisher, people have to pay money to buy it, okay? As an author, or in this case, I was the co-author, I have no control over that, yeah. But, for example, at the Abbey, when we buy books, the books that I authored, we put them in a room, and we make them for donation basis, yeah. And sometimes people come and they have no money and they want it, and we just give them the book, yeah. But you know, if people can give a donation, then that's really helpful because we have to buy the books ourselves. Okay, so that's the way we do it at the Abbey to avoid this kind of thing, and I really feel that it's good that way because then we give freely and other people support us freely. So then everybody's creating good karma, yeah? Whereas if you charge for teachings, let's say, or you charge for this or that, and then other people pay, then it's just business deal. Then nobody's creating any good karma, yeah? But if both parties are giving generously, and then, you know, if people can donate, that's good. If people don't have money, they can still have the Dharma. The Dharma should not just be for people who can pay for it. Yeah, I feel quite strongly about that. Yeah?
About keeping the first two steps.
Okay.
I mean, that staying in the house. We have to keep the pest away when we have pest control coming to the house.
Yeah.
What's your opinion about that?
Yeah, pest control is difficult, you know. At the Abbey, we live in the countryside. We have lots of other sentient beings sharing the land with us. Yeah. Just to give you an example how we dealt with it. A few years back, our washing machine, which was on the upper floor, had a leak. And it started flooding downstairs. So we had to open up the downstairs ceiling in order to stop the leak. When we opened up the downstairs ceiling, we found a huge, massive colony of carpenter ants. Yeah, there were many more carpenter ants than human beings at the Abbey, okay? We couldn't let them continue to stay there because they were eating the wood and making their nests inside. Yeah. So we had to cut things out and we took them somewhere else to live so they could live happily ever after away from the Abbey. Okay? And that's how we dealt with it. We didn't call in exterminators.
Well, you took them, was there any house there?
No, we took them into, because we lived, there was forest around, so we took them into the forest. We also have wasps and yellow jackets and hornets, you know, in the springtime when the queens start to make their nests, we knock the nests down. Yeah, before they put their eggs in, we knock the nests down, put them in a container, and take them somewhere else in the forest to live happily ever after. Yeah, so that they don't stink us by living nearby. So it takes some time and effort, but it's possible. And we had ants in, there was an outlying cabin, again, completely filled with ants. And we really didn't know what to do because we wanted to be able to use it, but nobody could stay there. There were so many ants. So we tried to block as many of the holes as we could. They ate through the stuff. They came back in. We did our best to relocate them. And then what was really amazing, you remember, we started doing There's one puja called a sur puja, where you offer sense to the kind of spirits who eat sense, and you know, to other living beings who have died and who are born in a realm like this where they eat sense. And so we started doing that puja. Now we do it usually every 2 weeks when we can. And the ants aren't in the cabin anymore. Yeah, I think somehow, because we noticed that their main colony was somewhere outside in the forest, and they were reestablishing it in the cabin, but now they just stayed themselves in the forest. They're not in the cabin anymore. So I think at some level, you know, offering food to these beings, you know, had some effect.
Have four cats in your abbey.
Yeah.
Like if they by nature chase a cockroach around and you saw it, do you stop them from chasing the cockroach?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So if you don't stop them, it's a bad karma on you.
Yeah.
And actually you don't stop them.
Yeah, well, we don't want other living beings to suffer. So
if they are like in the middle of living,
yeah,
you stop them,
yeah,
but then they would die slowly.
Our job is to save lives.
Even if it means like they're decapitated but they're not dead.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Just slowly let them die.
Yeah. We do what we can to save life and prevent torture. Okay. So we'll take a little break now and then come back and have some meditation. So that you can really think about the points that you've heard. And so remember that, you know, as you do the meditation, it's really to keep reflecting, oh, I could have been born in that situation, but look at the situation I have now.